भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Canto 11, Chapter 17, Text 29. Sushrushamana acharyam sadopasita nichavat yana sayasana sthanir nati dure kritanjali Sushrushamana acharyam sadopasita nichavat yana sayasana sthanir nati dure kritanjali Sushrushamana acharyam Sadopasita nichavat yana sayasana sthanir nati dure kritanjali Sushrushamana. Engage in serving. Acharyam. The bona fide spiritual master. Sada. Always. Upasita. One should worship. Nichavat. As a humble servant. Yana. By humbly following behind the Guru when he is walking. Sayya, by taking rest with the spiritual master. Asana, sitting near the Guru to render service. Sane, by standing and humbly waiting upon the Guru. Na, not. Ati, very. Dure, far away. Kritanjalihi, with folded hands. Translations by disciples of Srila Prabhupada. While engaged in serving the spiritual master, one should remain as a humble servant. And thus when the guru is walking, the servant should humbly walk behind. When the guru lies down to sleep, the servant should also lie down nearby. And when the guru has awakened, the servant should sit near him, massaging his lotus feet and rendering other similar services. When the guru is sitting down on his asana, the servant should stand nearby with folded hands, awaiting the guru's order. In this way, one should always worship the spiritual master. We're going to read two more verses. Chant all together. Evam vritta guru kule vase bhoga vivarjitaha vidya samapyate yavan vibhradrattam akhanditam. Until the student has completed his Vedic education, he should remain engaged in the ashram of the spiritual master, should remain completely free of material sense gratification, and should not break his vow of celibacy, brahmacharya. Purport. This verse describes the upa kurvana brahmachari, who enters grihastha ashram, or family life, after completing his Vedic education. The word evam vritta indicates that although one may eventually marry and become prominent in society as an intellectual, politician, or a businessman, during student life, one must remain without false prestige as a humble servant of the bona fide spiritual master. The Naishtiki Brahmachari, who never marries, is described in the following verse. Altogether. Yadyaso chandasam lokam aruksham brahma vishtapan gurave vinyase deham svadhyaratham prahadvrataha. If the brahmachari student desires to ascend to the Maharloka or Brahmaloka planets, then he should completely surrender his activities to the spiritual master, and observing the powerful vow of perpetual celibacy, dedicate himself to superior Vedic studies. Purport. One who desires the supreme perfection of life must engage his body, mind, and words in the service of a bona fide spiritual master. One desiring elevation to superior planets such as Brahmaloka and Maharloka must fully engage in the spiritual master's service. We can thus imagine the sincerity of purpose and service required to achieve the Krishnaloka planet, which lies far beyond the material universe. Om Gyana Timurandasya Gyana Anjana Shlapya Chakshuru Nitam Nina Tasmaya Shri. So this this chapter is description of the Varnashram system, social orders, and Krishna is describing the importance of service to the spiritual master in advancing in Krishna consciousness. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he calls this chapter the conduct of brahmacharis and grihasthas, so specifically for the first two ashrams. And he makes the point that at the beginning of Uddhava Gita, Krishna, and throughout the Uddhava Gita at this point, Krishna has described Jnana Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. And now in this chapter, Krishna begins to describe Karma Yoga, beginning with the description of the Varnashram system, Varnashram Dharma. And Krishna, he not only teaches this to Uddhava, but in his own life, he taught us by his own example when he was here, when he was born and grew up. He showed us that example of what the duty of the disciple is to the spiritual master. In that famous pastime in Mahabharata where the Pandavas, they were exiled, and they were drinking water from the pond of water that was owned by Yaksha. One of the questions that the Yaksha in disguise asked was, what is the way? That was the whole question. What is the way? And Yudhishthira Maharaj, he responded, Mahajano yena gata sapanta. That was probably one of the most frequently quoted verses by Srila Prabhupada. Mahajano Yenagata Sapanta, which means that the absolute truth or the way is not found in intellectual exercises or study of scriptures or penances or any of those external spiritual disciplines, but rather is found in the heart of the great souls. So the 12 Mahajans that are listed in the Bhagavatam, we're meant to follow in their footsteps. Mahajano Yenagata Sapanta. After Krishna came to Mathura and killed Kamsa, he met his real parents, Vasudeva and Devaki. And one of the first things Vasudeva did was arrange for Krishna and Balaram's second initiation ceremony. He gave him the Gayatri Mantra. And that Upanayanam was given by Gargamuni, who was the spiritual priest of the Yadu dynasty and other brahmanas. But when Krishna was first born in the prison cell of Kamsa, he celebrated the birth of Krishna by mentally donating so many cows, 10,000 cows, dressed in linen, silk garlands and jewels to the brahmanas. But he wasn't able to do it in reality because he was imprisoned and Kamsa had taken over his goshala. So after Kamsa was killed, one of the first things he did was he donated all those cows that he mentally donated. He actually donated them to the brahmanas, including Gargamuni and the brahmanas that conducted the second initiation ceremony for Krishna and Balaram. And during that ceremony, Gargamuni also performed the vow of brahmacharya for Krishna and Balaram. It is a special vow of brahmacharya during that time. And Krishna and Balaram, they wanted to take shelter in a gurukul. So they went to Sandipani Muni, who was a native of Kashi, the holy city of Kashi, and asked Sandipani Muni to take them under his shelter and become a disciple. And there's his disciple, which he did. And we know the story in the Bhagavatam that he taught all of the Vedas, the corollaries of the Vedas, the political science, Sam, Veda, diplomacy, and the martial science, Dhanur Veda. And Krishna and Balaram, they treated Sandipani Muni as the Lord, even though he was Lord himself. He treated Sandipani Muni as the Lord himself, as God, as good as God. And in return, Sandipani Muni also respected Krishna and Balaram, gives with so much love and kindness. And after there, and also Sandipani Muni taught Krishna and Balaram the 64 arts. It's described how they learn one art every day. And they would learn everything. Of course, Krishna's all-knowing, but in their lila, they would learn. As soon as they heard it the first time, they would immediately learn it without any repetition. So after the 64 days of learning the 64 arts, and of course learning all the Vedas, they approached the spiritual master. And this is very significant because the greatest wealth from the guru is actually service. It's not so much the externals, what we gain from the spiritual master, but it's actually the opportunity to serve him. That's the greatest gift that the guru actually gives the disciple. Because it is through that service that we can regain our constitutional position as the servant of the servant, of the servants. So, and it is the spiritual master's mercy to accept that service. So Krishna and Balaram approached Sandipani Muni and asked for some guidance. What can they give as Guru Lakshmi as a donation? Guru Lakshmi. And Sandipani Muni consulted with his wife, and they decided that the only benediction our Guru Lakshmi they wanted from Krishna was the recovery of their son, the young son, who was captured by the ocean waves at Prabhas Kshetra. And this is also really significant because in the prosecution of service, we can never give up. We have to be determined. We have to persevere. And this pastime of Krishna and Balaram bringing their lost son back is a perfect illustration of this. We were just discussing in a nectar devotion class the quality of Krishna as steady. And the Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they explained the meaning of steady is performing one's service in spite of insurmountable obstacles. So no matter what obstacles are there, that Krishna would never give up his duty. And the example I give is the pastime of Banasura. And it's a long story, but essentially Krishna ended up having to fight Lord Shiva. And nobody has ever dared to fight Lord Shiva. Of course, Shiva never dared to fight Lord Krishna either. But it's all his lila. So they explain that Krishna never gave up his duty in that story, and perfectly exhibited the quality of steady, of commitment to one's service, in spite of insurmountable obstacles. So here, Krishna and Balaram, the first thing they did was they went to the ocean and demanded this lost son of the guru. And the deity of the ocean, ocean personified, came and said that I don't have his son. Actually, he was captured by the descendant of deity, Panchajana. So, of course, Krishna could have, and they could have stopped right there. I mean, they met with the ocean personified, but Krishna, he went to the bottom of the ocean and killed Panchajana and found that the son was not in his possession. And it was actually lila. The acharyas explained that just like Jay and Vijay, they were never really demons. They were Vaikuntha Vasis. In the same way, Panchajani was just taking the part of a demon so that Krishna could perform this pastime to reclaim his original Panchajana Kansha, which is his eternal Kansha. Panchajanyo Madhishikesho Devadattam Dhananjaya. So that's his eternal possession. So Sandipani Muni's son wasn't there either. They had no direction of where to go. So on their own accord, they went to meet Yamaraj, the abode of the hellish planets, king of death. And it's described how as Krishna was approaching the capital city of Yamaraj, I forget the name, is it Samyamani? Is that right? He blew his Panchajanya conch shell. And when he blew the conch shell, it's a beautiful description of how the sound of that conch shell was so pure that Astipravan hell, where the leaves are sword-like, and the bodies of the sinners are ripped apart in shreds. Those sword-like leaves just kind of fell off. And in the hell of Kumbhikana, the boiling of oil stopped. And in the hell of Bhairavi, all fear went away. Because this is like the most intense fear. And the Ruru beasts in the Rorava planet, of course we all remember the descriptions of the hellish planets in the Bhagavatam. The Ruru beasts disappeared as soon as Krishna blew the conch shell. And actually it's described that every single inhabitant of Yamaloka went to Vaikuntha hearing that Panchajana conch shell. So this is the potency of transcendental sound. So Krishna, he asked Yamaraj for the son, for his guru's son, and he immediately gave the son, brought him back. And Krishna and Balaram, they said, give us more service. You know, we want to do more Guru Dakshin. And Sandipani Muni said that having you as disciples is my only wealth, is the only wealth that I can ever ask for. There's nothing more I could ask for than that. And they returned to Mathura, and everybody was rejoiced to see Krishna and Balaram again in Mathura after such a long time. But in the Vishnu Puran, there's a famous verse, Namo Brahmanya Devaya Go Brahmanya Taicha. Krishna not only worshipped his own spiritual master as his master, but he worshipped the Brahmanas. Any sadhu or saintly person, he treated as his own spiritual master. Later on, in the Bhagavatam, there's a beautiful story that, we all know the story, that perfectly illustrates Krishna's supreme love for the Brahmanas. So one of his classmates in Gurukul, Sudama Brahman, was living with his wife. And they were both, as we know, very, very, very poor. And they were starving. They didn't even have enough to eat. They were literally starving. And the acharyas explain how actually his wife, Sudama Brahman's wife, was even more tolerant than Sudama Brahman. Because if ever she got some food, she served it to her husband. So she was even more tolerant of hunger than her own husband. So, on one occasion, Sudama Brahman's wife approached Sudama, and she was trembling with fear. And she was trembling because she knew, before she even asked, she knew that the only thing her husband would ever ask of Krishna is pure devotion, is love for him. He would never ask for anything else. So she was literally like trembling in fear of her husband. But out of love for her husband, she just couldn't tolerate seeing her husband in that condition. So she, before asking her husband to go beg in charity from his old friend Krishna in Dwarka, she anticipated every single argument her husband could ever make before she made the proposal. So after she figured out every single possible objection Sudama Brahman could give, she had already had an answer figured out. So she said, Krishna is, he's the well-wisher of Brahmins. Why don't you go and beg of him some little material prosperity? I mean, we're householders. We're entitled to some material wealth. And, of course, Sudama objected, saying that, I'm not a Brahmana. And I'm how can you say I'm a Brahmana? I can't. If I were a Brahmana, perhaps, but I'm not a Brahmana. And she said that, okay, you're not a Brahmana. But Krishna bestows his causeless mercy on those who surrender to him. And Siddhartha Brahma said, I have no devotion. So I don't even have the quality of surrender. So I know I can't approach Krishna because I'm not surrendered. So then she said that, okay, you're not surrendered. But Krishna's devotees are so merciful. They'll give you, you know, something in charity. And Krishna is also the shelter of the most wretched. And can you deny you're the most wretched? And Siddhartha Brahman thought for a second. He said, but I'm too embarrassed to ask. I can't ask. And then she had an answer for that. She said, my dear husband, you don't even need to ask. Krishna gives himself simply by remembering him. Just by remembering Krishna, he will give himself what to speak of unlimited material wealth and opulences. So his wife actually repeatedly, still didn't convince him, repeatedly requested her husband to go approach Krishna. And he was dissatisfied with his wife's behavior. He initially was dissatisfied. But then he came around and he reasoned within himself that, yes, I will become fortunate by having darshan of Krishna. So there, that is a reason for me to go. But how can I go to see my friend Krishna empty-handed? I don't have anything. So he asked his wife, what am I going to give him? So immediately she actually went to another Brahmana and begged from that Brahmana family 4 handfuls of flat rice. Stale, hard, tasteless flat rice, handfuls of tasteless. And so he carried it with him, she gave it to him, and he started walking to Dwarka. And then he was thinking to himself, how am I going to have darshan of Krishna? The guards are not going to let me in Dwarka. I mean, look at me. How can I? And actually on the way to Dwarka, he was joined by some other brahmanas. So that gave him a little bit of encouragement. Some other brahmanas were going to see Krishna in Dwarka. Or it doesn't actually say to see Krishna, but they were on their way to Dwarka. And when he came to the the outside, the Dwarka, it was guarded by three encampments of soldiers, which he had to go through. And on the, in the inner chambers, there were three watchtowers that he had to go through. And he walked past the palaces of the Vishnus, like Uddhava, and he became stunned when he stood in front of one of the palaces of Krishna's 16,000 queens. He became totally stunned. He forgot who he was. He forgot why he was there. He forgot what was happening. He just completely forgot. He just kind of stood there, staring at Rukmini's palace. And at that same time, Krishna was right inside the palace, sitting on his consort's bed. Kind of looked, peered up through the lattice of the windows, and he saw Sudama just standing there. He immediately got up. He started walking. He went into the courtyard and immediately embraced Sudama. And it's described how when Krishna touched the body of Sudama, he was experiencing ecstatic symptoms of love. And tears were flowing from his eyes. And he brought Sudama very lovingly inside his palace and seated him on Rukmini's bed and worshipped him. The descriptions are unbelievable, how much he worshipped Sudama. Later on, it's actually described that Krishna was massaging Sudama Brahman's feet after seating him. And he offered incense, ghee lamp, sandalwood, and he was glorifying him with sweet words. At one point, Sudama Brahman was thinking to himself, does Krishna know who I am? Because maybe he's mistaken me from somebody else. I'm just a lowly, sinful beggar. I don't understand what's happening. Maybe he forgot who I am. So Krishna, being the all-omniscient Supreme Lord, understood what his devotee was thinking. And to clear this doubt, he started talking about their experiences in Gurukul, saying, do you remember the times when we were together in Gurukul? And of course, keep in mind, Sudama Brahman has not said a word. This entire time, he's been silent. And Krishna speaks about his times that they spent together in Gurukul. And he first glorifies the position of the spiritual master. He says that there are actually three spiritual masters. There's the father who gives birth to the body. There's the master that gives upanaya, the second initiation. And then there's a spiritual master who teaches about me and teaches all the other ashrams about me. And I'm not as pleased as I am by worship of that spiritual master than by anything else. That the worship of that spiritual master who teaches knowledge about me is the greatest spiritual master. So he glorifies the spiritual master to Sudama. And then he speaks about one specific incident of... actually, Krishna was thinking to himself, he was seeing how the description of Sudama the Brahman was, he was so thin that he had veins, and his whole body was covered with veins, and that's how thin he was. And Krishna was thinking how that in a short period of time, this is all going to change. So he describes the one incident that took place when he was in Gurukul, where Sandipani Muni's wife had asked Krishna and Sudama to collect firewood. And when they had gone outside to collect firewood, an unseasonal storm came. And there was wind, there was rain, there was thunder, there was flooding, and then the sun set. They couldn't see anything. It's described that they actually wandered aimlessly the entire night. They wandered aimlessly because they couldn't see anything. And it's described how when the sun set and they couldn't see anything, they held hands the whole night, Sudama, Brahman, and Krishna. And somehow or other, all the firewood they had collected for the spiritual master's wife, they were carrying that the whole time during this whole experience. So, in spite of so much difficulty and so much hardship, so much austerity, couldn't even see anything. They barely, for a normal person, their main focus would just to be, just to survive. Even in that situation, they did not let go of the purpose for their trip, which was service. So they held on to that firewood. And the next day, when the sun rose, Sandipani Muni went out to find them and glorified them as perfect disciples. And he said that you've gone through so much hardship and this body is so dear to us and you completely disregarded the body. And he said that the duty of the disciple is to give their wealth, all their wealth, all their assets, and to give their very lives. And the acharyas explain how each of those descriptions of a perfect disciple represents the antidote to the two conceptions that keep us bound in the material world. Aham, mameti, the two conceptions of I and mine. By giving our lives, we relinquish the conception of I. And by giving all of our wealth, we relinquish the conception of mine. And that is the duty of every disciple. So Krishna then told Sudama that we had many incidents like this. It's not just this one. We had so many incidents. And then Sudama Brahman finally spoke for the first time. He said that with you as my friend, what else is there? There is nothing else I could ask for. All these disturbances and miseries and austerities, they're just your pastimes. And he was remembering this passage from the Taittiriya Upanishad saying how out of fear of you, the wind blows. So this all has been orchestrated by Krishna himself. So he gave all glory back to Krishna. And in this discussion, at one point, Krishna started to smile. And he just couldn't stop grinning. He just couldn't stop grinning because he was thinking to himself, my friend has come from so far, and it's not possible he came empty-handed. And then that grin turned to laughter because then he was thinking, how long is he going to wait before giving me what he brought? Then he was laughing. And Sudama, he understood. And he bowed his head in shame because he just could not conceive of giving Dwarkadish four handfuls tasteless, dry, stale, flat rice. And Krishna was thinking that, of course, it's not the external, it's the love of his devotee that Krishna wants. So he snatched the flat rice, and it's described how the flat rice was in a strip of cloth. It was an old strip of cloth, and four handfuls were in the strip of cloth, and it was kind of rolled, and Sudama Brahman had tied around his waist, so it just kind of looked like a copan string, you know. But so Brahmana, yeah, so Krishna grabbed this this bundle of flat rice and ripped it off his waist. And immediately, he took one handful of that flat rice and ate it. And he was thinking that, I need to eat more of this flat rice because I'm going to give him the treasures of Indra and Brahmaloka. I need to eat more of this flat rice, otherwise how can I do this? And Rukmini stopped him, saying that your satisfaction is the cause of unlimited wealth in this world and in all the three worlds. You don't need to take a second bite. And actually, through her glance, her loving glance, she communicated to Krishna that if you take that second bite, there'll be none left for me. In fact, if you gave one grain of rice to every single member, every single maidservant, all of my co-wives, all of the maidservants, you wouldn't have enough. So what about us? And then simultaneously, she cast a glance to her maidservant saying that this will upset my Prabhu's stomach. So she had both sentiments at the same time. Of course, that sentiment wouldn't have worked with Krishna. Because Krishna was not thinking in those terms. He was enjoying that flat rice very much because he was tasting the bhakti of his devotee. So that was Rukmini's argument to Krishna, and she simultaneously had another argument for maidservants. And it's described how Sudama spent the whole night with Krishna. And he was fed sumptuously, he was drinking sumptuously. And Krishna was thinking that the heart of my devotee is so pure, the heart of Sudama was so pure, that even if I forced charity on him, he would refuse it. Even if I forced him to take it, he would refuse it. The only way I can give charity to Sudama is if I do it silently so that he doesn't know. So the next day, Sudama Brahman was walking back and he was thinking, how compassionate is my Lord. He didn't even give me a little wealth because he knew that if he did, I would become proud and that I would forget him. And I would become absorbed in sense gratification. How compassionate is my Lord. Didn't give me even a little wealth. So of course, we all know the story. When he came to the place where his house was, there were these tall, like palatial buildings and gardens and courtyards and ponds of water and birds cuckooing and maidservants, you know, like, in tuxedos, and he's saying, finally, finally, attired maidservants walking around, you know, with gems on. So the first thought he's had was, where's my house? And the second thought he had was, after he realized that this was his house, the thought was, how did this happen? And then, at that moment, some maidservants came, but they didn't approach him because Sudama, see, there's two types of Nishkam devotees. One Nishkam is described that they are indifferent to material prosperity. Whether they have it or they don't, it doesn't make any difference. And one example they gave was Prahlad Maharaj, that, you know, he was the king of the whole universe. And but yet he was a pure devotee. He was indifferent, whether he had it or not. But then there's a second type of Nishkam devotee that is completely averse to material sense gratification. And the example that they give is Jad Bharat. That material sense gratification was so repulsive to these types of devotees that they live such severe, austere lives, that austerities we can't even conceive of. They're just so averse to sense gratification. And acharyas explain how Sudama was actually in that second category. He was averse to sense gratification. And that the only reason why he was there was because of compassion for his wife. But then Krishna thought to himself, but his wife is completely loyal and dedicated to her husband. So she was just doing it for him. So, Sudama finally, mentally, said, okay, Krishna wants me to have this. And so when the maidservants approached him, when they saw that Sudama Brahman's mentality changed, kind of surrendered, then okay, Krishna wants me to have this, I'll have it. Then they approached him. The maidservants approached him as their master. And at that moment, Sudama Brahman's wife, Sudama Brahman saw his wife running towards him, just completely in ecstasy. And it's described how the night before, she was, her whole body was emaciated, her clothes were torn, her face was totally withered away, and the walls in their house were crumbling, they're falling down, and the roof was crumbling. And that's the state that she was in when she fell asleep. When she woke up, her whole body was totally transformed. And, of course, her whole residence was totally transformed. And she immediately knew what happened. So she came out running to meet her husband. And she was so happy for her husband. And she paid obeisances and embraced him within her heart. Not externally, but within her heart, she embraced him. And Sudama Brahman went inside the palace, and he was thinking to himself, why didn't Krishna tell me he was going to give us his charity? Because Krishna is so accustomed. He always tells Brahmins to take charity, and he's always giving charity. Why did he not tell me that he was going to give me this charity? So then Sudama thought, the only explanation is that Krishna was thinking that this palmful of flat rice is greater than all of my possessions put together. It's greater than all possessions that I have, all my opulences. That I'm ashamed that I have nothing to give him. So all I'm going to give him is just the meager opulences of Indra and Brahma. And I'm so ashamed and so embarrassed that I'm just not even going to say anything. I'm just going to give it, because I have nothing to give in return. And the acharyas explain how that Sudama Brahman was thinking that Krishna was like a magnanimous rain cloud, who the rain cloud also feels ashamed that I have nothing to give, and pours down its rain at nighttime when the farmers are sleeping, because they feel that whatever they have is so meager, so worthless, that I'm ashamed, so I'm gonna pour down my rain at nighttime when the farmers are sleeping, because I can't face the farmers. So the nature of Krishna is that he considers his opulences to be insignificant. And he magnifies the small offerings of his devotee. Actually, Krishna, this is really far out. In the Bhagavatam, I don't know if you remember this, but one of the verses that Krishna speaks to Sudama Brahman is word for word exactly the same verse he speaks in the Gita. Patram pushpam palam doyam yomi bhaktya prajati. Did you read that? The same exact verse that's in the Gita, Krishna speaks again to Sudama Brahman. And the Acharyas explain that Krishna uses the word bhakti twice because he wants to emphasize it's the love, it's the intention in which the offering is given, not the external thing. And the second point is that when Krishna speaks this verse, he intends to say that I will eat the flower. And the flowers are normally not edible. Well, flowers are inedible, right? But Krishna intends to eat the flower because he is overwhelmed and bewildered by the ecstasy of that love, that he would eat something that is normally inedible. And we all know the story of when Krishna was given banana peels by Vidura's wife. You know that story, right? So that verse actually points to that story, that Krishna is so overwhelmed in ecstasy that he eats a flower. Ashnami, he eats. Where was I? So that's what Sudama Brahman was thinking. This must be the reason why Krishna didn't tell me. And he has described how for the remainder of his life, he actually slept on the earthen floor, was constantly immersed in chanting the holy names and hearing the Bhagavatam. And he was thinking to himself, a great devotee like Prahlad Maharaj, he's unaffected. But a neophyte devotee, if he gets material opulence, then it's very dangerous. So I have to be very careful. So for the rest of his life, he lived very austerely, even in spite of all the opulence. He stayed on the floor. And Sukadeva Goswami said that Krishna is the Yajnabhuk, the master of all sacrifices. He's the god of all gods. And he is the cause of all causes. Yet, he makes the Brahmanas his own master. So there's no deity greater than the Brahmana. The Brahmana is the greatest deity of worship. And that whoever remembers Krishna's favor and love for the Brahmanas will soon develop love for God, for Krishna, and return back to Godhead. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Sorry for going over time. You had a question? Question, comments?
I was interested in this, these two types of nishkama devotees. Prahlad being one that's just indifferent, and then Sudama having aversion. Was there any more description of that? Is there one that's a higher level, or are they both?
There was no mention of one being higher than the other.
Yeah.
No.
Like Jamunacharya, he would spit at this thought of
right. Yeah.
Sometimes we have a conception, you know, that the aversion is the opposite side, or the
right, yeah,
converse of attraction. Yeah,
yeah, it's attraction and aversion. They refer to the sense objects. So we're not attracted, and we don't feel aversion to an object of our senses. But what Yamunacharya was averse to was enjoying the sense object for his own sense gratification. That's what he was averse to. And a lot of times, you know, it's easy to misunderstand that we become averse to the objects of sense objects. But we love everyone, we love everything, and recognize that they're all Krishna's property, meant for his enjoyment. But we're averse to me enjoying that selfishly.
Of course, it's within the context of his high taste in Krishna consciousness. That's what, because he knows that if he goes there, then he loses that. You know, this is, it's one or the other. You're either Antaranga Shakti or Bahiranga Shakti. Oh.
Thank you. Sorry, I didn't have anything else to say on that.
You know, you were talking how Krishna showed some satisfaction with those, you know, flat rice, tasteless, dry, hard, whatever. Well, sometimes he shows a different face. When Sanatana Goswami was walking in Vrindavan, he saw this Brahmin, Mohandas Chauvé, was in Vrindavan in his courtyard. His son was playing with a Gopal deity in the courtyard, throwing sand on it and the deity and having a good time. So Sanatana Goswami went and he chastised the Brahmin. He said, "You're really disrespectful to the Gopal deity. That I have to teach you the proper way to respect and worship the deity." So that night, Gopal dreamt Sanatana Goswami said, "I was having so much fun with it, you know, in the pastime, and now you came and messed the whole thing up." So he said, "So now I want to come with you. I want to come and stay with you." So Sanatana Goswami said, "Well, I'm just a mendicant. I have nothing. You know, there's nothing that I can offer you. I can provide for you." He said, "No, that's okay. Whatever you're eating, you can offer that to me." So he said, "Well, all I have is like dry chapatis, and that's all." So Krishna said, "No, that's okay. Whatever, if you offer that, I'll accept and I'll be okay." And he said, "I don't think so." He said, "You know, are you sure that you're not going to ask for anything else?" He said, "Yes, I'm sure. I'm not going to ask for anything else." So anyway, Sanatana Goswami used to do his bhajan under the tree, and sometimes he would tie Krishna up on the tree with a rope. So like that, and so one day, Gopal said, he talked to Sanatana Goswami, said, "Well, every day you're offering me these dry chapatis, can you at least put a little salt?" So he said, "I told you not to come with me, that I know afterwards you'll want salt, and the next thing you want something else." So anyway, the pastime goes on with the next day that the salt merchant got stuck in the river, and he came to Sanatana Goswami and asked for help. So Sanatana Goswami knew exactly whose trick that was. So he said, "I can't help you, but go and see that little boy you asked him. He's going to help." So sometimes he has the pastimes with his devotees. Yeah, and I just want to mention that.
Thank you. Yeah, I love that story. Thank you.
So when I listen to this story, what comes so much to my mind is the chastity of that wife. And I want to know if a wife is ready to give up her own advancement spiritually for the sake of serving their husband.
The question is, what is the question? Is it okay for the wife to give up her own advancement?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
For the sake of serving her husband.
Is that okay? Yeah. So, not only is it okay, it's it's highly recommended for every person. Our acharyas explain over and over and over and over, so many times, that if we are striving for our own spiritual advancement, it will never get there. The only way to become advanced is to render service to please the devotees of Krishna and to give them happiness. And our own spiritual advancement is not for our own purpose. It's to give Krishna and his devotees pleasure. That's why we become spiritually advanced. It's for the pleasure of the devotees. It's for the service of the devotees. Nothing is for ourselves. And if we start thinking in terms of, let me become spiritually advanced so that I can become spiritually advanced, if that is our goal, we'll never become spiritually advanced. And the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj, explains the nature of that love is that is we please Krishna's senses, and the more his senses are pleased, we're pleased. To please the devotee's senses, the more then we become pleased. But our spiritual advancement is meaningless without the advancement of everyone around us. That I'm not going back to Godhead unless all of you are going back to Godhead. That's the real meaning of going back to Godhead. If you think in any other terms, you're not going back to Godhead. But if you think of, I'm not going unless all of you are coming, I'm not going to go. And that your going back to Godhead is more important than me going back to Godhead. That's when you go back to Godhead.
But in that case, how can the wife think like that if she doesn't care about her own advancement?
Well, her advancement is the service. Right, just like my advancement is how well I can please my spiritual master. Right? In other words, my advancement, it comes not as... My goal isn't to become spiritually advanced. My goal is to please Krishna and, this, and the Guru and Krishna. That's my goal. And my spiritual advancement is just a byproduct of that. Does that make sense?
So it doesn't matter how advanced your husband is. You will make advancement.
I would say it again?
So it doesn't matter how advanced your husband is, you are sure to make advancement.
I see what you're saying. So, I believe my wife told me that if your husband is fallen, you can leave your husband. So this my understanding is that you don't want to serve. I mean, you're not required to serve a husband who's not a devotee, right? But yes, I mean, if he's striving for Krishna consciousness, then absolutely. I mean, all of our acharyas, even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said, I don't think of my disciples as my disciples. They're all my spiritual masters. So no matter who we are, we never feel anyone's less advanced than oneself. You see what I'm saying? So yeah, the husband for the wife is more advanced than the wife, even if the wife is more advanced. The wife never thinks that way. And the husband is the same way. He never thinks he's more advanced than his wife. He thinks that the surrender of my wife is so exalted, and the humility of her heart is so magnanimous, that and I'm so proud, my heart is so hard, that I'm never going to go back to Godhead without the mercy of my wife. So no matter who you are, you never feel that the person that you're serving is less spiritually advanced than oneself. Does that make sense? Thank you.
I would just say that it's a very sensitive topic, and there's so many factors involved. And I think a really important way to deal with that is to get really good advice from devotees about specific situation and confide in devotees and get, good advice in that situation.
Especially Mother Mati Mataji.
That's because she's your wife who's more advanced, so that's why I gave
it. I am her husband. Correction.
Oh,
Mataji has...
Oh,
that should, yeah. I'm sorry,
it's getting late. I just want to add one thing. There is a statement in the Garuda Puran, I don't know the Sanskrit, but the English is that a chaste wife thinks that service to her husband is greater than service to the demigods, service to the ministers, service to the Supreme Personality of God Himself. And with that, the Lord becomes very pleased. Yes, it's there, and that was quoted by our acharyas, and might even there in Srila Prabhupada's writings. But it's there in the Garuda Puran.
I believe Jagannath Das Babaji said something similar to a husband, saying that you should treat your wife like a gopi and put her on the altar and worship her every day.
Put her on the
I believe Jagannath Das Babaji said that. If you read the pastimes of Jagannath Das Babaji, you know, one person asked for, you know, how should I treat my wife? You know, treat her like a gopi and put her on the altar and worship her every day.
That's a good thing to end with. Maybe I shouldn't speak. when I was coming in, I was hearing you say we shouldn't want to, our goal shouldn't be to make advancement, but to please the guru. Just to make one distinction, I've always thought we should not want to become an advanced devotee, but we should aspire to advance on the spiritual path. You know, make that endeavor to advance. So there's a distinction.
Yeah, I mean, it could be misunderstood, but you're right. I mean, our advancement is pleasing the spiritual master. In other words, you see what I'm saying? That is our advancement.
It's
through pleasing the spiritual master and Krishna.
That's the essence. Yeah.
And if our goal is to advance spiritually, we're not going to advance spiritually. But if our goal is to please Krishna, to please the spiritual master, to serve Krishna, to serve the spiritual master selflessly, that's our spiritual advancement. So it's not that we don't want to be spiritually advanced, but we want to be spiritually advanced through the proper channel. Just to clarify what I said before. Thank you, Mataji. About making that distinction, though, that's beautifully said. The reason why I'm repeating myself over and over again is because I need to preach to myself. So I'm sorry, Mataji, for interrupting you, but you're inspiring me. Jai Gantra Chumar Bhagavatam Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai.